Good morning. This is Chair Peter Fisher. Pursuant to House Rule 10.01, I call this remote meeting of the Behavioral Health Division to order. The clerk will take the roll for attendance.
Good morning, everyone. Frederick.
Present.
Frankie.
Frankie, present.
Backer.
Backer, present.
Baker.
Baker, present.
Becker Finn.
Present.
Hansen.
Hansen, present.
Katiza Watoon.
Present.
Lippert.
Lippert, present.
Moeller.
Present.
Pearson. Pearson. Thompson.
Thompson, present.
A quorum is present.
Thank you. With quorum present, we will continue with the agenda. Our next item on the agenda is the approval of the minutes from Wednesday, February 10th. Are there any questions or corrections of the minutes? If not, the chair would entertain a motion to approve.
So moved.
It's been moved, and who is it? Was that Representative Frederick?
Yes.
Okay, Representative Frederick moves the approval of the minutes for February 10th. Please unmute for a voice vote. All in favor of approving the minutes, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails and the minutes are approved. Members, we are taking official action on one bill today and then reverting to an earlier conversation regarding the governor's mental health uniform standards proposal, which was introduced as a bill on Monday. But we will not be having any official actions taken during this hearing on that bill. We will try to split our time evenly between the two agenda items we have this morning. We will start with the first bill on the agenda, that is House File 944. Representative Hansen, as a member of the division, you may move your bill. And I believe you also have an author's amendment. Would you like to go ahead and move your bill, please?
Thank you, Chair. I move that House File 944 be recommended for a referral to the Human Services Finance and Policy Committee, and I would like to move the A1 amendment, which it includes some mutually agreed upon changes between the advocates and DHS, which will just help us better accomplish the bill's overall intent.
Okay, Representative Hansen moves the A1 author's amendment to put the bill in the shape she would like for its first committee stop. All, please unmute. This will be a voice vote. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. Representative Hansen, please go ahead and present your bill as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members of the committee, for hearing this important bill. Each year, 700 children enter voluntary placements through Chapter 260D. To receive mental health care at residential treatment facilities. And today's bill essentially treats mental health treatment in a residential facility like it would any other condition or any other level of mental health care. It would be based on medical necessity, and the state would pay for room and board costs for children who otherwise would have used Title IV-E funds. For children in voluntary placements, these Title IV-E funds reimburse counties about $2.1 million. Here's some background. Our children's mental health treatment system has gone through several major changes. In 2001, CMS allowed counties and federal Medicaid dollars to be used to pay for the cost of care for children's residential facilities. The portion of costs associated with mental health treatment that was not covered by federal Medicaid dollars was the responsibility of the county. In a similar way, counties were also responsible for the cost of room and board and sought reimbursement through Title IV-E funds for youth whose families met the program's income requirements. This funding mechanism was negotiated as the state was working to more fully optimize its ability to capture federal dollars through Medicaid. It was a benefit to counties as youth in foster care through the child welfare were always eligible for Medicaid, and this approach helped counties better optimize that federal reimbursement. So since 2009, state and federal Medicaid funds have covered the treatment component of mental health residential placements for children enrolled in the PMAPs, while the counties continue to be responsible for those room and board costs. In 2007, DHS, the State Court Administration, children's providers, and advocates, they came together and put in the work to develop a new chapter of law, which was 260D. This allowed for voluntary placements for children. This new law made it clear that parents retained custody, retained decision-making for their child, and that they did not have to go to court, but they still had to file paperwork. This created a separate door, if you will, for families whose children needed treatment due to their mental illness. And this way, it did not feel like the family was going through the child protection door to receive services. And then the Family First Bill was passed by Congress in 2018. And essentially, Family First removed that second door and required that everyone go through the child welfare door because we were using child welfare funding. So it's important to note that CMS decided in 2018 that these children facilities were IMDs. So the state couldn't use Medicaid dollars anymore. The legislature then appropriated money to fill in the lost Medicaid dollars. And what we're asking for today is for the state to fill in for the loss of Title IV-E funds so that families don't have to go through the child welfare door to receive the services. Mr. Chair, I'd like to turn it over to Sue Abderholden from NAMI to share more information about why this bill is so important.
Certainly. Thank you, Representative Hansen. Ms. Abderholden, if you'd like to identify yourself and who you're with, please, and start your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. Sue Abderholden, Executive Director of NAMI Minnesota. Last year, when the legislature heard the department's bill to implement the Family First legislation, NAMI vigorously opposed it. We did not want parents of children with serious mental illnesses to fully go through the child protection door. And you directed the department to meet with stakeholders to see if there was another way. If Mr. McCall could pull up the small chart that we made. As you can see from the chart, children with mental illnesses access several levels of care through their health plan, looking at medical necessity. So private insurance, PMAP, Medicaid, they look at medical necessity when going to a hospital. Those same plans look at medical necessity when going to a psychiatric residential treatment facility, although I will note that most private insurance right now won't pay for it. Private insurance looks at medical necessity when a child goes into a children's mental health treatment facility. But if it's Medicaid or PMAP, with PMAP, they first look at medical necessity. Then it goes through the county child welfare door, as it does with Medicaid. And so you can see that for almost all of the other intensive services, we treat this as medical necessity until we get to a children's mental health treatment facility. You can take the chart down now. Thank you. It doesn't really honestly make sense to me. And I want you to understand how hard it is to be a parent of a child who has intensive mental health needs. It's exhausting. You are trying to keep them from hurting themselves or others. You are desperately trying to find a hospital bed or the right therapist or in-home care. You may have other children and a job, and you feel like you are not able to keep all the balls in the air. Finding intensive in-home services is nearly impossible because, honestly, they don't exist. And so then you finally decide, with the help of a mental health professional, that your child needs residential treatment. And then you find out you have to go through child welfare. And honestly, this scares parents. You are so afraid of being judged when you've done the best that you can. But this is extreme parenting. This is not normal parenting. And by the time you reach this point, you are an emotional and physical wreck. And now someone who may not be a mental health professional is going to send a letter out to all of your child's relatives to see if they will care for your child. People you don't necessarily, know, are going to gather around a table and decide your child's treatment fate. And honestly, for any of you who are parents out there, none of us would want our parenting judged when we are in a crisis. We are not at our best, but we are doing our best. As Representative Hansen noted, we used to require parents to relinquish custody in order to obtain residential treatment. Then we required them to go through the child protection door. Then we allowed for voluntary placement agreements, so at least you didn't have to go fully through that door. And now we are back at the child protection door, making families who are not found to be abusing or neglecting their children to go through relative searches and large screening teams. We asked families who, honestly, to ask them to come today when they're so stretched during this time, we just asked them, what are your thoughts, frankly, about asking the county or having the county reach out to your relatives? And here's some of the quotes. This is infuriating. Would they ask a relative to care for my child with cancer, heart disease, or diabetes? I would not support this. In our case, we did not have any relatives who could monitor our daughter for self-harm and suicidal attempts 24 hours a day. Absolutely not. The presumption is that the problem is bad parenting skills rather than the child in need of specialized care. Residential treatment is completely different than a sleepover at a relative's house. These kids need professional help, not babysitting. And my favorite comment was, no. It's hard enough to care for and worry about a child with a serious mental illness. I had a child who struggled, well, she's still alive, but I have a child who's, when she was younger, really struggled with depression and anxiety, and it is not an easy path. And so to now have to go through a process that will delay access to care and will frankly serve to humiliate parents by treating them as if they abused or neglected their child is simply something we strongly oppose. We need to treat this as we do other level of intensive treatment as a healthcare issue. If the state or county pays for room and board, families won't have to go through the child protection door. And this bill will do that. It will have children and their families go through the same process as if they were going to a PRTF or a hospital, the door for medical care, not child welfare. Now, we know there are some details that still need to be worked out with MACSA, but the implementation of Family First will take place this September. So we urge your support for the bill, and we promise to work with the counties to see if we can, you know, figure out some of the details. Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you, Ms. Abderholden, for your testimony. Next person we have is Ms. Andrea Vasquez. If you'd like to identify yourself, who you're with, and start your testimony, please.
Hi, good morning. I'm Andrea Vasquez with Volunteers of America and representing Aspire Minnesota, a statewide association of children's service providers. Mr. Chair, Madam, and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of House File 944. This legislation creates an important opportunity to build our children's mental health system around the primary treatment needs of our children and youth. It seems logical to align intensive residential mental health treatment with standards for medical necessity, instead of relying on our child welfare system to screen and fund treatment for children with intensive mental health needs. House File 944 is another building block for Minnesota as we design a system that is responsive to children, youth, and their families. As a seasoned administrator, I have directly seen the many hands that are involved in placing youth in residential treatment. We know that delaying care for children with this level of need can place a child and family in increased risk. Building more efficient systems is undoubtedly in the best interest of children and families. As a clinician, I have seen firsthand the exhaustion, desperation, and hopelessness that families can go through when trying to get their child intensive mental health care. Parents scramble to find available resources and how to access them. I've spent hours with families in tears, with extreme anger, stating how difficult it is to access care. Often what families discover is that they need the support of our child welfare system for their child to receive care, which they cannot understand. What HF 944 offers is a path that is more aligned with these family experiences and access to vital care that can provide needed mental health treatment for their child to begin the healing process. With this, I have a couple of families that come to mind. One family whose teenage daughter had experienced trauma at an early age in her home country in Eastern Europe, was adopted as a toddler to an American family. The long-term effects of the trauma caused the child to severely act out physically towards her parents, engage in serious self-harm, and was unable to develop secure attachments with loved ones. The family had tried every level of care, including family attachment therapy, to no avail, and the parents were at their wits' end. Children's residential treatment was a recommendation, and their daughter was finally placed in residential care and was able to transition to community life with intensive outpatient services in place after 6 months of care in residential. Another family, a single mother and her teenage son experiencing his first episode of psychosis, came in for an assessment as the youth had grown more and more distant, isolative, and non-responsive to the outside world. This single mother also suffered from mental illness and was significantly struggling to take care of herself and her son, of whom she adored. She worked at a fast food restaurant and could barely make ends meet. After a psychiatric evaluation, it was determined that the young man was experiencing true signs of schizophrenia and that he would need residential treatment to receive further assessment, treatment, and care to stabilize his diagnosis. This young man was able, in the end, to attend an intensive outpatient program for young adults with first episode psychosis. And with medication and therapy, after 3 months, he was able to receive a lower level of care and return to the community. One final family includes a grandmother and her teenage grandson, who had been severely traumatized by the early death of his mother due to a drug overdose. He was very young and shortly after started to exhibit extreme behaviors of aggression at home and at school. The child started to become suspended and eventually expelled from school. The grandmother had a very difficult time attempting to navigate the mental health services and was close to having her own breakdown. She was scared of her own grandson. The school counselor connected the family with outpatient resources, and it was quickly determined that the child needed residential treatment. While in the trusting environment of residential care, the youth was able to begin to understand himself, the root of his negative feelings and aggressive behavior, as well as coping skills to live as a healthy human being in society. Thank you for considering HF 944 and the importance of building a system that honors, responds, and meets these families with the individualized care and treatment that they both need and deserve.
Thank you, Ms. Vasquez, for your testimony. At this point, I'll open it up for questions. Does anyone have questions of our testifiers or of our bill author? Representative Backer.
Thank you, Chair. And then we had some good testifiers, but what I'm looking for is, with this bill, to better understand this bill, if I had a child with a mental issue, explain me, just street smarts, how this bill would help me. You know, I know there's been talk that this will improve this, this will improve this, this will help here, here's some concerns here, but as is with no amendments, explain me where this helps to streamline things, because I do agree with the process. This is a very clunky process that we have in Minnesota. So how does this bill help to be less clunky?
Who'd like to attempt that? Ms. Abderholden, if you'd like to go ahead, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. What we hope will happen, Representative Backer, and this is why we need to continue to meet with MAXA, that the child is on Medicaid or PMAP, and it was determined it was medically necessary for the child to go to treatment, they would not go through a county screening process. They would go then directly to the residential treatment. The tricky part comes in is if a child is uninsured, or perhaps their private insurance is only going to pay for a few weeks or something like that. That's the part that we still kind of need to figure out how that would work. Does that help?
Representative Backer, excuse me.
That does help. When you say that there, I'm assuming, and I'm getting a look, so I apologize, Chair. This is heading to what committee next?
My understanding is that the next committee we'll go to will be Human Services.
Okay.
Our reports go straight to them after we're done with the bill here.
Okay. So thank you. And because I'm like you, if it's clunky here and it isn't clarified, now we've got a couple other stops, we got to unclunky it, because as we know, children in that type of scenario and their parents, they need some stability to help to get through the process. And as you work through, I'm foreseeing a potential amendment down the road. You're welcome to share that with me, because I know when we were in majority, you and I worked a lot on these issues. So I would like to see that when it gets closer. I might have some ideas too. So for now, that's what I have. Thank you, Chair, and thank you, ma'am.
You're welcome. Thank you, Representative Backer, for the input and interest in being involved with this bill going forward.
Close, Backer,
Chair. Backer. Thank you. Darn it. I apologize. Okay. Next, we have Representative Frankie. Representative Frankie, if you'd like to go ahead, please.
you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members. I want to thank Representative Hansen for bringing this bill forward. I have a few questions. I'm glad to see that the amendment fixed several of the concerns that I had about the bill prior to getting the amendment or even the MCASA letter late last night. I'll just start out by, let's see here. On the amendment, I was wondering if the author could let me know why we're just reinstating the residential treatment facility and not the rest of the explanations on page 2, line 13. I'm glad to see that some of that language was reinstated, but are we just leaving that vague for a reason, just as a whole residential treatment facility, to not like pigeonhole ourselves, or how does that work?
Representative Hansen, would you like to answer that? Or I think I saw Ms. Haberholden's hand go up. Who would like
would like for Sue to answer that. She is very good at explaining the complexities of this. So if it's okay with you, Representative Frankie, I would like to let Sue explain that.
Ms. Haberholden.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So right now, counties don't screen for a child to go into acute care hospital. I mean, it's just, you know, that was in the Children's Mental Health Act many years ago, but they don't do that. And we don't really have regional treatment centers anymore, so especially for children. So it seemed like that was kind of archaic language that doesn't really happen. So it seemed, you know, like we should take it out. The one thing I will note is that if a child, you know, young person is going into a chemical dependency facility, they don't go through child welfare screening.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Haberholden. Representative Frankie, further questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Somebody could answer for me. Is this a voluntary placement only situation?
Ms. Haberholden?
Mr. Chairman, yes. Because otherwise you have to go, I mean, you've already, if a child is, you know, if the family is being accused of neglect or abuse, they're already referred then to the child welfare, and so they're already in that system.
Representative Frankie.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On to my next question for the author or the testifiers. Why are we deleting in the entire section 4? I noticed some of it may be archaic language, but nothing that I can see was reinstated. So I'm kind of wondering why on the amendment we're deleting the entire section 4.
Mr. Chairman?
Go ahead, Ms. Haberholden.
This was on the advice of the Department of Human Services. They said that the language we had added, the new D, was not needed, that we didn't need that language, and so we deleted Section 4 of the bill.
And we also do have the department available for answer questions also. Representative Frankie.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Ms. Haberholden. So what section or what area of the bill should I be referring to then to look to that then replaces or refers to?
Ms. Haberholden, or should I?
Mr. Chairman, it will actually be on the in section 6, where we're then saying that if a child is eligible for residential services without a referral from the county, that it can kind of go straight forward that way.
Okay. Representative Frankie.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll check that out. And then on to my next question, Mr. Chair. The amended line, page 6, line 25, where it inserts, except the Commissioner of Human Services or Managed Care Organization retains authority to make determinations related to medical necessity and clinical appropriateness of placement. Does this supersede any parental or custodial rights?
Ms. Haberholden.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Franke, it should not. That additional language was at the request of the Department of Human Services. Personally, I didn't think we needed it, but they wanted it, and so we put that in. But we just wanted to make sure that it was clear that parents retain legal custody and that they don't give it up.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Amberholden. Representative Franke.
Sounds good. No, I think this is a needed bill. I am wondering about the fiscal impact of this, you know, and how we're going to work this. I'm hoping that, you know, reading this Mikasa letter, that, you know, there are some issues on how these payment structures are all going to intertwine to get this accomplished properly. So I want to make sure that we're getting this done right. You know, when it comes to good policy, we want to make good policy moving forward that is feasible and attainable to, you know, accomplish what we want to get done here for our kids. So I appreciate it. And that's all the questions I have, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you, Representative Franke. Ms. Amberholden, you have something you'd like to add?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, if I might, I just want to pledge to the committee that we will work with MACSA. We know we can't come in with a bill that's going to cost $30 million or anything like that, so we will work with them. We do feel, you know, somewhat under a time pressure because this will go into effect in September. I think we all felt, as you can see in Max's letter as well, a little frustrated that we couldn't find a solution before the session started. But I promise you, we will work with them and try to figure this out.
Thank you, Ms. Amberholden. I do not see any further questions. At this point in time, I will turn it over to Representative Hansen for any final words she may have.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, members of the committee, for hearing this important bill. I know it is a complex subject, but it is, like Representative Franke said, very important that we make sure we address this and are helping out these kids and families. So thank you for your time, and I look forward to your support.
You're welcome. There being no further discussion, Representative Hansen renews her motion that House File 944, as amended, be recommended for referral to the Human Services Finance and Policy Committee. Mr. Kroos will take the roll.
Fisher.
Fisher, aye.
Fisher, aye. Frederick.
Aye.
Frederick, aye. Franke.
Aye.
Franke, aye. Backer.
Backer, aye.
Backer, aye. Baker.
Baker, aye.
Baker, aye. Becker Finn.
Aye.
Becker Finn, aye. Hansen.
Hansen, aye.
Hansen, aye. Katiza Watoon.
Aye.
Katiza Watoon, aye. Lippert.
Lippert, aye.
Lippert, aye. Moeller.
Aye.
Moeller, aye. Pearson.
Pearson, aye.
Pearson, aye. Thompson.
Thompson, aye.
Thompson, aye. And 12 ayes and 0 nays, the motion prevails.
The motion, with 12 ayes, 0 nays, the motion prevails. House File 944, as amended, is recommended for referral to the Human Services Finance and Policy Committee. Thank you, Representative Hansen. At this point in time, I will be turning the chair over to Representative Frederick as my bill is the next on the agenda.
Members, the second bill on the agenda is House File 1495, authored by Chair Fisher. We are not, however, taking any official action on the bill today. Chair Fisher, please begin your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, House File 1495 is the Governor's Health Mental Health Reform Uniform Standard Service proposal, which we've been discussing. We started the discussion on this back on February 10th on a conceptual level. After conferring with Representative Franke and staff, I agreed that given the length of this bill, it's 211 pages, plus a number of pages for sections that are being taken out, that it would be appropriate for us to spend time on this committee, not doing any motions today, but just to be able to walk through the bill and give us all time to digest it. And I have agreed that the department will do the walkthrough of the actual language. There's also an A1 amendment that was provided to members, which reflects additional clarifying changes to the bill. The department will also explain that language as well. As Chair Frederick noted, we are not taking any votes in this hearing, so this is an opportunity for members to better understand the proposal and ask clarifying questions. It is my intent that we will vote to adopt the A1 and pass the bill out of committee next week. If members still have questions for the department after today or would like to propose any changes to the bill, I would encourage you to use the next week to have those conversations so we can hopefully vote it out of the committee on March 3rd with broad support. Members should have the bill itself and the section-by-section summary provided by staff available for the reference as we do this walkthrough. And for members of the public, these documents are posted on the committee website as well. Mr. Chair, I would suggest that we stop after each article of the bill for questions. With that, I invite the department to begin their presentation.
Thanks, Chair Fisher. We have one speaker to that, Mr. Ashley Wortman from DHS. Also available to answer questions, from my understanding, we have Ms. Grom and Mr. Burdick from DHS as well. If Mr. Ashley Wortman, if you want to begin your presentation.
Thank you so much. Thank you, Chair Fisher and members for more time today to talk about uniform service standards. As we discussed on the 10th, USS has three core values. Improving equity, asking who hasn't been well served by current regulations, how can we support providers doing better in person and family-centered work. Value and clarity, we wanted to rethink and simplify requirements, eliminating any steps that don't improve care. We wanted to improve the process, working towards a single unified review for providers, even if they're doing multiple service lines, providing clear expectations from providers and from DHS. We also talked about the challenge that we faced in doing this work. There was complexity built into the system over time, layers of systems that we had built, seizing opportunities, trying to build the systems that Minnesota needed, but some of these dating back to the 1950s. There were unknown dependencies. Would cleaning up one piece break something else? A lot of mapping out to make sure that we were addressing unintended consequences. And then finally, the sheer mass of language. We talked about all of the different definitions of mental health professional as an example, all of the cross-references and locations we'd need to fix in order to untangle the status quo. So as mentioned, we do have a bill over 200 pages. That's a lot. It's why we've had such an open stakeholder process all along the way, reviewing and re-reviewing language to ensure that it does what we want it to do. And I really hope that today's discussion is part and parcel of that. We'll be providing this walkthrough with more detail, but for the sake of time, we're still not going line by line. If there are areas where you have further questions, we'd be happy to discuss further detail here or offline in the week before the 3rd.
Mr. Ashley Wortman,
so,
I just want to let you know that your video is slightly choppy, and I just want to make sure that we're able to hear your testimony. So I don't know if it would be beneficial to cut the video or not, but I just want to make sure that everybody doesn't have an issue with being able to hear you at all.
Great. I'll give that a try. Thank you. If folks would turn to the handout that we gave, I believe it was titled section by section outline. And this is what I'll be using to review the bill. So in Article 1, we have the core standards. This is where we're trying to pull together all of the different standards and requirements that providers are required to adhere to. And in Section 1, we have a purpose and citation. We're explicitly connecting the work of USS to what has come before. This does build on the Mental Health Acts. It builds on the Medicaid services that we've built. In Section 2, we have the applicability. This is an incredibly technical section, but it's very important. This is about managing the transition in a reasonable way. We have a lot of different ways in which providers are currently being approved by DHS in order to provide services, and we want to make sure that we're moving people over into a unified licensing structure in a way that makes sense for them and for DHS. And so ERTS and residential crisis will move from a longstanding variance to Rule 36 and into statute. Rule 36 is fairly antiquated. It does not have a lot of specificity to it, And so moving these into statute will provide stronger standards. We still do need Rule 36, however. The security hospital, Andrews residents, other locations still do use it. The certification for mental health clinics would move from the antiquated Rule 29 and into statute. It would remain an optional certification, mostly sought by folks looking for improved negotiations with insurance companies, or they're looking for the 23.7% rate enhancement that's available for certain R29s. Programs currently certified by the Behavioral Health Division will retain that approval process, but they'll start adopting the core standards. Services will then be prepared for moving into a unified licensing framework as we're ready in later sessions. Section 3 is probably my favorite. It is a stable and singular reference point for terms that are used across service lines so that we don't repeat definitions. This is what really helps us prevent some of the statutory drift that we've seen the example that we gave with the 47 different definitions of mental health professional. And so we've taken definitions, pulled them in, we've cleaned them up, and provided a single place where we can refer to. That way in the future, if we need to make changes, it's editing in one place and it instantly applies across services. In section 4, we set standards for the establishment, enforcement, and maintenance of policies and procedures. This is something that automatically happens for most programs under 245A, the Licensing Act. However, because we're blending things at this point in order to move through this in an orderly transition, we still do need to have some of this language in parallel. And so we've put that here in 245I03. Once we've made this transition fully, we'll be able to remove much of this language. Section 5 is provider qualifications and scope of practice. This is the definitions for professional, for practitioner, that have been in multiple locations in the past. One new piece here is that currently we refer to clinical trainees, somebody who's in advanced training, they're going to become a mental health professional in the future. They can do a diagnostic assessment. They can do a therapy session. We've referred to those clinical trainees and other mental health practitioners as a single entity. We've talked about mental health practitioners. This definition clearly breaks them apart and says there are mental health practitioners. The qualification is usually around bachelor's level plus some experience or about 4,000 hours of experience. That's a different staff position than the clinical training. So we break that apart for clarity. Training requirements in Section 6, there was a lot of variation between the training requirements depending on how a person got qualified as a staff person, what service line they were working with. And so this was an area where we really wanted to do some cleanup and alignment. We do have significant specificity on what's required for children's services. We heard loud and clear that there were pieces about serving children that really did need to stay unique, and we preserved that. One of the things that I'm excited to see how it works is a training year, allowing providers to get all of their staff on a single training cycle as opposed to tracking, you know, multiple different start dates based on when a person first joined the agency. We have enough upfront training required that we feel confident that then that ongoing training really can be lined up without, requiring person-by-person tracking. In Section 7, we've renamed clinical supervision to treatment supervision. Clinical supervision is currently covering both what we require in mental health services for the purposes of quality assurance and assuring that folks get adequate care. And it's also the name of the process by which a senior, licensed independent clinical social worker would supervise a licensed graduate social worker or things like that. And that's provided some difficulty. There are some very specific standards within the boards of practice about who can train up you know, a new social worker, a new LMFT. We want to be a little bit more broad in what we require for the day-to-day supervision of staff. That, for our purposes, really can be any mental health professional. It doesn't matter what field it is. And so we've renamed our process to treatment supervision. And we've, in the author's amendment, you'll see some reduction in the specificity of the requirements here. We have previously required that folks maintain a log of the supervision being provided. However, that really in some ways discourages day-to-day small interactions. That recording process is still probably going to be useful for clinical trainees who need those clinical supervision hours. But in terms of the supervision of other staff, that treatment supervision record just isn't going to provide the value that we were looking for. And so by agreement with stakeholders, we've pulled that out in the author's amendment.
All right, Mr. Ashley, I'm going to pause you for a second there, and that way we can get to some questions before we get too far past it.
Yes.
Representative Franke.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is all the way back to Section 2. I was wondering if you could explain the variance request process and who and why would they do something like that?
Yes. So the variance request process is standard across many areas of DHS. Currently, 245A has variance authority. 245G, substance use disorder, has variance authority. And we've modeled that language after that. We did put in one clarification in the author's amendment that DHS would not consider a request to vary staff qualifications. This is very often linked to payment integrity. We've told CMS that a mental health practitioner has these qualifications, or we've told them that a clinical trainee has these qualifications. So we wouldn't entertain a request based on staff qualifications. That being said, this is an incredible amount of change that we're asking folks to go through. And just like we saw with 245G, the variance requests are an opportunity for us to round out some of the rough edges and come back in the future. We've used, for instance, in Rule 29, DHS currently has variance authority over Rule 29, and there have been frequent requests to modify the 60% limit for any one guild within the service, the requirement to have a professional at each location and not just clinical trainees, the requirement to have certain amounts of staffing, no matter how small the clinic is. DHS took those variance requests that were being done so widely and so frequently that they became the new de facto standard, and we brought that forward as part of the USS process. So we'd intend to return with pieces like that for further legislative consideration.
Mr. Chair,
thank you.
Any other questions, Mr. Franke, Representative Franke?
No, thank you, Mr. Chair.
I believe I also saw Representative Baker's hand up.
Mr. Chair, I put it down for a second only because I wanted to maybe hear more of the presentation, and I maybe have a question a little later on for the author. So I'm gonna stand down for now, Mr. Chair, and I'll just listen to more. Thank you.
Sounds good. Mr. Ashley Warden, please continue.
Thank you. So on page 2 of the handout, sections 8 through 10, there were significant differences in the documentation requirements for an instance of a service, for client files, for personnel files. And so we brought those together in a consistent manner. On to page 3, assessment and treatment planning. This is really where I think we have some of our most significant reforms. The diagnostic assessment is currently laid out in the outpatient mental health rule, as well as several locations in statute. And overall, the challenge has been the speed and the complexity combined. The DA needs to be done up front, and the DA has a lot of different elements. And so we've built in more flexibility to build trust and engagement, a little bit longer period for folks to work on some of those immediate needs. We heard some testimony on the 10th coming from Lucas Kunaka-Frazier about how that ability to be immediately seen and helped as opposed to answering questions is really something that is valuable for folks. This also contains some reforms to the treatment planning process. We heard from Children's Therapeutic Services and Support CTSS providers about how the frequent renewals of the treatment plan, as well as a requirement for parent signature, could cause interruptions in care. We've moved practices in this proposal to accept a documented phone conversation. What really matters is that we have a parent who's being engaged, has opportunities to ask questions. Whether or not they've signed the document is really less important than whether they were involved in the care and got the opportunity to guide that care. We also have a 30-day grace period proposed there so that if, for whatever reason, provider isn't able to immediately get a hold of that parent, maybe they're going through their own mental health crisis, they've got a period of time in which they can try to intensively reengage the parent, but still continue working with that child and providing stability. This has come up with kids who are coming to school-based services, the school-linked mental health, and the parent isn't necessarily there, or it's another relative. They've been sent to live with grandma and grandpa for a while, and grandma and grandpa don't have legal custody, but they certainly do have physical custody of that child. And so working through those pieces and balancing parental engagement, which we really value, and consistency of service. Section 12 is about safe administration of medication. We have seen overall a tendency of as new standards to prevent the diversion of prescription drugs have been brought up in higher levels of care, that the challenge of diversion has then spread out to other levels of care. And so we wanted to make sure that we had some solid pieces there in order to protect staff and clients. In Section 13, we align client rights to existing authorities, primarily the Healthcare Bill of Rights in 144.651. And then in Section 14, we have a reporting requirement for critical incidents. This applies to residential programs where the level of responsibility for the client safety is the highest. Then in Section 15, we have the modernization of what's currently referred to as the Rule 29 certification standards for mental health clinics. And again, as mentioned, we used those variances that we were already granting in order to drive the future state, that folks wouldn't have to apply and ask for what we were going to say yes to, that they could simply move forward and do it by right. We eliminated some highly prescriptive requirements around case consultation, individual supervision hours, internal utilization review, and peer case file review. We replaced them with broader and more flexible requirements to implement quality assurance and improvement planning as designed by the provider, something that they're going to find useful for their own circumstances. In Section 16, we simplify and move to statute the standards for ERTS and RCS programs. As Brooke Schultz talked about from RADIUS, we allow some more time for initial documentation and assessment. Those first days in an ERTS program can be very hectic, and so we spaced out some of those requirements. We reduced the frequency of the assessment so that there would be more time for meaningful and documentable progress in between those assessments. And then we have the discharge standards. This was a really important and tough discussion, and I really want to applaud all the folks who were involved. We heard from advocates. We heard from the operators. We heard from licensing. We heard from homeless shelter operators, the Office of Ombudsman, all coming in with different and very significant concerns. When you have someone who is destabilizing in an ERTS program and may need a higher level of care, you have someone who is at a unique point of vulnerability, and we need to do our very best to treat them, to offer them the support they need. An ERTS program is also looking after up to 15 other people who are also vulnerable. And so we have to weigh those things and make sure that we're serving both the rest of the program and the individual who is most in crisis. And so we've proposed some pieces that would ensure that the case manager and the family natural supports get contacted before the discharge is finalized, and put some documentation requirements around what happens, especially when a program is discharging against the client's wishes.
Take another quick pause here for questions, Representative Mueller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I had a question about Section 14, critical incidents. And I went back and I looked at the definition in Section 3 of critical incidents. And those are some pretty serious situations. And I was curious why there was 10 days was what the decision, why the decision was made for notifying the commissioner within 10 days and not maybe even a sooner timeline than that.
Mr. Ashley Morgan.
I will need to look that up and get back to you on that question. In many cases, we were adopting timelines that are currently required, but I will double check on that and get back to members.
Representative Backer.
Yeah, this question would be for the agency, obviously. You know, quite a few tweaks are being put into this. Were these tweaks from providers, or was this tweaks or changes more from the agency? How did you derive these changes and suggestions here that you're looking at? You could, because we got quite a few sections here. Is this all agency driven or 90% agency driven? Or because obviously the people who have to implement it on the streets, that's a whole different game from the agency. Thank you.
Absolutely.
Sorry, was that direct, question directed at Chair Fisher? I had a hard time hearing the first part.
I think it's directed toward DHS.
Yeah, that's more of an agency question. Yes, yes, Chair and Representative. That's a more agency question. If you guys can, if you want to dab into it too, but it is more of an agency question.
Mr. Ashley Morgan, if you'd like to respond.
I can feel that. Thank you, Representative Chair. The process really started with provider concerns. As we talked about on the 10th a little bit, this was something where we had heard a drumbeat from providers that we needed to take on the challenge of excessive paperwork in our services. And so that was really the genesis of the program. That being said, we've also had internal concerns, pieces that we've known are not clear for us when we're offering technical assistance and guidance on what a provider's obligations are. The process that we've used since spring of 2019 has been a combination DHS and external stakeholder design team. We had majority external folks and minority DHS representing different areas of the agency. We had MAXA representation. We had children's providers from Aspire. We had Mental Health Providers Association, Minnesota, NHPAM, MACMAP. We had Catholic Charities operating both mental health and homeless shelters. We had a lot of different folks coming to the table, and we would put out, you know, broad outlines of the areas that we wanted to look at, take their questions and feedback. We used text polling to make sure that we were hearing from everybody in the room, and we would proceed iteratively from there. returning with answers to questions, identifying priorities, doing further work on those priorities, moving, you know, hand in hand the entire way. This has been an incredibly collaborative process, and I really value everything that the providers and advocates in counties have brought to the table throughout.
I don't see any more questions for right now. Representative Backer.
Question. I appreciate that. Just a real quick follow-up question. So before this has been presented to us today, is it a fair assumption that people reviewed it, the providers and the stakeholders are on board, or do they still need to do that there, that process?
Mr. Ashley Warman.
We have been meeting regularly. The initial design teams were monthly, and we were going through, you know, starting with high-level concepts and moving to language that entire process. We did have an interruption in the work due to COVID-19, but then starting again this fall, we've been meeting regularly with stakeholders, and we've been going over, you know, we've been doing the line-by-line, the, you know, word-by-word kind of work with that stakeholder group, again, representing MAXA, MHPAM, Aspire, NAMI, others, and I'm sure we would be happy to arrange for folks to talk to you about what their experiences have been.
I just one more. Well, thank you, Chair. My concern is there's always good intentions, and this is more of a nonpartisan issue, is there's those unintentional consequences that sometimes puts us down a rat hole, worse than where we were before. So that's why, and I appreciate your effort. Obviously, you've put a lot of time in this, and we appreciate it. But my last question is from your perspective right now, going through all this due diligence, anything coming to mind on what would be some unintentional consequences from this language?
Mr. Ashley Warman.
You know, I think the biggest thing for us to work through is going to be communication of the change. It is one of the reasons why we have requested staff resources within this proposal, working through, in particular, the discharge standards and ERPs. We know that that has been a concern, and without clear standards, we haven't been able to offer enforcement on that area in the past. It's going to take time. It's going to take effort in order to bring forward clear guidance on those areas and to work with providers to build up their capacity to meet these. We've given ourselves, I think, a decent runway. We've targeted a July 1st, 2022 live date so that we have the time to move through that and to get to a place where we're all ready to go. And it's also, again, to Representative Frankie's question, it's why we did put in some variance authority for DHS so that if those unintended consequences do crop up, we're able to address them in the short term and then return to the legislature for further changes and adjustments in order to get to a better state.
Thank you. That's it. Thank you, Chair.
Okay. Sounds good. Mr. Ashley Warman, if you want to continue.
I just wanted to return briefly to Representative Miller's question. I have heard from licensing, and they've been able to offer some further information. If it is an alleged maltreatment or death, there is 24 hours to report. Other critical incidents reporting is where the license holder is administratively providing DHS with information so that if we can identify trends or concerns that we may have to follow, and that does reflect the present state of what is required.
Any questions or comments, Representative Mueller?
No, thanks for that follow-up. I appreciate it.
Absolutely.
Okay. We'd like to please continue, Mr. Ashley Warden.
In section 17, we pull together the coverage of different mental health services that have been in 256B 0625 or in the outpatient mental health rule 9505-0372. These are usually smaller service lines that may be provided more directly by a single professional or single clinical trainee. This is an opportunity for us to, again, use standard definitions and have a set of requirements that applies across services instead of having multiple repetitions. And then also, because we are repealing that section of rule, we needed to make sure that those services, such as dialectical behavioral therapy, partial hospitalization, that those continued to be covered by Medicaid. In section 18, this directs DHS to continue the work. This is not a finished project, and we know that we have more to do. The future services that we're targeting for transition into this unified licensing framework would be mobile crisis response, adult rehabilitative mental health services, assertive community treatment, intensive treatment and foster care, children's therapeutic services and supports, and intensive rehabilitative mental health services. We also have children's residential and psychiatric residential treatment facilities, NSUD. These are already licensed, so they're under that licensing framework, but they would also benefit from analysis and alignment with USS core requirements so that we're supporting solid integration. DHS will continue to work with stakeholders to plan and prioritize that work. I'll pause before we go to Article 2.
Representative Frankie.
Thank you, Chair. I guess this isn't really on any specific section right now, but I'm wondering if the agency and maybe Chair Fisher, if you know, you could answer this. So right now we're going through this large summary, sorry, my glasses are off, of the original language, but then we were provided with 9-page amendment of multiple changes. How does this language and all the changes of this amendment affect what we're hearing now of this summary? Because I would like to see the amended language
referenced,
because some of this might be, you know, moot. Can the agency maybe answer that?
Chair Fisher, the agency wants to jump in.
As we've done this presentation, I've tried to highlight areas where there have been significant changes. For the most part, the items in the amendment are below the level of what we provided in the summary. And so in most cases, it doesn't change. The documentation requirement for the treatment supervision was one of those places where it did change, and I tried to make sure that that was called out. That was probably the most substantive change that was made in the amendment. The other area that would be, potentially substantive is there was simply missing language. There was a drafting error in 245I-20 that missed a couple of subdivisions. Those were replaced with the author's amendment. So those two would be the most notable pieces. Perhaps the one more that I would then mention would be the weekly team meeting. This is on page 6 of the amendment. As we remove some of the the specificity on documenting individual instances of supervision. At that point, the weekly team meeting, which we had made optional earlier in the proposal, really should then be something that is standard and required. It is currently required. This maintains present state, and we had extensive consultation with stakeholders in doing so. It really was about eliminating that concern about the hyper-prescriptivity of the treatment supervision documentation, and so that was the best way for us to move forward. I do appreciate that we have a lot of moving pieces in this, and I understand that we're asking for a significant amount of trust in this process, and this really is, again, why we have been at the table with as many people as we have, so that we have many eyes in order to catch all of these different pieces and make sure it all makes sense.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, thank you for that answer. And I guess part of what your last statement there would prompt me to say and maybe ask Chair Fisher if I know we're not taking any official action on this today, which means the amendment isn't getting adopted onto it. But if we could get some draft language with the changes, maybe available to us and to anybody who may want to study this to see how that changes or affects their, thought on this entire bill, as we're talking about, this is almost a generational change to our entire DHS process in this. I mean, we're talking policy and procedures, provider qualifications, staff training, supervision, personnel files, documentation, client files, assessment and training, assessment, treatment planning, health services, medications, clients' rights and protections, that we get this information all bundled together so that everybody has a chance to take in that information, study it, and make some informed decisions. And that would just be my question and ask Chair Fredrickson and Chair Fisher and to the agency. Thank you.
Mr. Chair? Representative Franke, that is a very good suggestion there. As I'm understanding, it would be great if we could get an unofficial engrossment of this bill with the A1 amendment already incorporated in, so that when we meet next week, we can have the what the language is with the amendment already incorporated in. Is that correct?
Yes. Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, Chair Fisher. So then we have something that, everything lines up instead of going from the bill to the amendment to the, I understand the situation we're in here. This is all very cumbersome, and this whole process we're living with right now. But not only for us, for the providers and everybody involved, just so we can streamline this as easily as possible. And when we're talking about these major reforms.
Okay, Representative Franke, thank you. And I appreciate the suggestion. This is why we're taking our time going through to figure out how we can make sure that we can have it understandable. The amendment was adopted, I know, in the Senate yesterday. So they should already be working on the revised version from that. And so what we can do is ask that as soon as that's available, we can get it out to the committee so that we have a chance to work on it. So we will make note of that here so that we can keep things moving along. Thank you for the recommendation, Representative Franke.
Any other questions, Representative Franke?
No. Thank you, Chair Frederick. Thank you, Chair Fisher.
All right, I will invite Mr. Ashley Wortman to continue.
Thank you. And I would just note for folks who are interested, we do have currently internally a further index that breaks down mostly to the subdivision level, so getting even more granular detail, and that does reflect the author's amendment. We're happy to do any further walkthroughs with folks as they're interested. Within the Crisis Services Article 2, this reflects a charge from the legislature issued in 2015 to return with improved standards for crisis response based on some of the new investments that were made in that year. We've returned with language along these lines in 2017 in the governor's policy bill, and then also an earlier version of the uniform service standards that was proposed but not passed in 2019. And so we're bringing that piece back as well. The major piece that we're doing here is that we're unifying adult and children's standards into a single section. We still want to be able to call out where children's standards need to be different, where the training needs to come into play. But there were simply too many differences between these service lines, despite them being primarily offered by the same teams. And so those differences were creating a lot of confusion. So we bring, in sections one and two, we bring some language about children into the Adult Mental Health Act, so it creates a unified set of standards there. In section three, we replace the Children's Mental Health Act language with a cross-reference to that newly combined section. Then in section four, this will actually break out by subdivision because this is a more extensive piece of language here. 256B0624 is currently the adult Medicaid coverage for mobile and residential crisis services. And we edit in references and coverage for children within this. In subdivision two, we rewrite definitions to cite over to the USS Corps for consistency. We combine the definitions of crisis and emergency. This was something where we had significant regional variation. Some teams saw a distinct difference between a crisis and emergency. Most did not. And so we merged those two definitions to get to better clarity there. We, in the next section, subdivisions 3 through 4A, we clarify the duties of a mobile crisis team versus a residential provider. We had situations where adults would go to a residential crisis provider. They would self-present. They had been there before. They had been referred directly by a case manager, pieces like that, making sure that that residential crisis provider had the ability to do their own intake without necessarily calling the mobile team, and that that the residential provider didn't have the same 24/7 response required as the mobile team does. In the next subdivision, we align staff qualifications to the USS Corps standards. We also rewrote it for clarity, trying to make clear the complement that we're looking for. We want a team that is able to provide the requisite supervision. We need a professional in order to guide the response of the team, but then we also need folks who are able to respond out into the community. So that's the rewrite there. In subdivisions 6 through 6B, we break out the different phases of crisis service. We're taking a lot of current language, but we're breaking it out into specific subdivisions for ease of understanding. There's screening that first happens by phone, initial assessment that takes place in person or by telehealth, and then there's intervention that takes place in person or by telehealth. We have in this section a renewed emphasis on service to families and other third parties. This is something that we heard pretty consistently, that there were regional differences in terms of how teams were responding when it was a third party calling. And so we tried to clarify that we really do want service to the family, to the support network. That person was in the community the day before the crisis, and they're going to be in the community afterwards. How do we build up that support network so that they're able to do that safely and successfully? We put in some language prioritizing prompt consultation and documentation when referring a client to an emergency department. We heard extensively from stakeholders that that was a really critical piece in in ensuring that if a person was being directed to an emergency department, that they weren't immediately being discharged back out to the community. In the time that it takes to get to the hospital, a person may be at a different phase in their crisis. They may be somewhat more calmed down, but we also have that unmet need still under the surface. And so the documentation from the crisis team can provide a fuller picture to the hospital so that they understand what they're looking at. We place a priority on calls coming from emergency departments or from law enforcement that is considering a transportation hold. This is something where we have had extensive and ongoing stakeholder discussion. We're currently going to be doing a survey with providers and MAXA for the counties leading the crisis services in order to make sure that we are solid on the language that we've chosen for response to third parties. In subdivisions 7 and 8, we clarify the requirements for crisis stabilization. We align it to USS Core standards. In subdivisions 9 through 11, we delete the separate requirement for a client file. This is covered by USS Core standards at this point. And then we clarify the supervision and treatment planning that's required. Again, that's about making sure that we have a professional promptly checking in with that practitioner who's leading the response. Normally, we reserve diagnosis for professionals and clinical trainees. And the assessment that a mental health practitioner, so that may be bachelor's to 2 years experience person, the assessment that that practitioner is doing within crisis services isn't quite a diagnosis, but it's more intensive than we normally would allow a practitioner to practice. We need that for the staff flexibility so that we're able to meet needs in this 24/7 environment of mobile crisis. But then we also need to make sure that that supervision is really solid, that they're checking back in promptly. And that's what this language is. Then in section 4, we edit the covered services to include items from children's crisis. And then we, again, have some clarification language that the residential crisis provider can do their own screening for the purposes of admission, but it's not billed separately. It's part of the per diem that they're already getting paid. And with that, I'll pause.
Not seeing any Representative Baker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I assume that's kind of DHS's kind of wrap up. I think that I see Mr. McCall kind of maybe nodding his head. I think that's what it is. But I just wanted to make Mr. Chair and the author, Representative Fisher, that I learned a lot about this process through about 4 years ago when I was carrying the major SUD reform bill in the House that was similar to this. It is incredibly complicated, incredibly detailed. I want to thank DHS for really, you know, going through so much of this. And I think some of my colleagues have sort of signaled that one of the concerns that might be there is really what are the providers saying about this? How engaged were they? When you see things move from rule statutes to statute law, that can be real problematic for providers. And I learned a hard lesson several years ago when I did this. And I think to the author, Representative Fisher, you're doing this the right way. We're taking our time a little bit, but this is still way more than just two meetings for part-time legislators that don't understand half of what the gentleman from DHS has said. It's just, we're not wired this way. We're not mental health providers. And if we are, we would get this a lot better. I think my comments only are this, is that what we should do as a committee is reach back to our providers in our district quickly, like later today, just get them this overview and help them understand this is what we're talking about. Get me information back. It's not that we don't distrust our DHS friends. What we have to do is to verify before we, the legislature, kind of gives our stamp of approval to move this forward. Because again, I've learned a tough lesson before that even though a lot of the SUD stuff I worked on, a lot of it was real problematic, and we're still trying to dig out of some problems that have happened since then. And I think that I just wanted to give that advice, because a lot of things in here will change. And these are some of the questions you should really ask your providers when you go back. While this was going on, I've sent a couple emails to my local providers in my district to say, hey, I need help with this. I want to know, how does it affect their workforce issues? Will this help or will this hurt? Will it make it more challenging for training? I know that there's some training changes in here. How about reimbursements and payments to them? Is it more problematic? Is it more clunky? I want to make sure that we do now what we are supposed to do and take this kind of a major reform thing back to our folks so we have something to come back to. And I certainly would expect, and maybe this is the plan, Chair Fisher, is to at the next meeting we have providers kind of lined up, or there's a number of them, or we can provide that. Maybe that's already the plan, so I don't want to get ahead of this, but I wanted to just share with members, this is a new committee. This is something that is really good to do. I have more trust today with DHS and their upper leadership than I have in a long time. And I will tell you, this is still major stuff. And there are things here that I'm sure are not going to be loved by our local providers, but it's our job now to take it back to our districts and our homes to make sure if we sign off on this, that we really have heard from our folks directly. So I just want to share my experience with this type of reform. I know some of it is coming federally. I know there's been some changes internally here, but I just wanted to make that comment and to, again, I think Ben did a nice job giving us a really nice overview, but I just want to make sure that our providers aren't saying there's about two or three things here that from a licensee complexity, or if it's just this workforce is a real problem for me because they're making it more challenging to do X, Y, and Z. We need to hear from them. And so I just challenge our committee. And with that, I'm glad we can try to take a hard look at doing things better. I am fighting the department all the time about trying to lessen the load on licensing and complexities and the layers of the onions. Our providers in all these medical fields are getting overwhelmed with paperwork, and it's just something that we have to keep vigilant on, and I challenge us to do this better than we did a few years ago. So that was more of a statement to you, Chair Fisher, and to the committee. I think we've got our work to do now. We've got homework to do. I would suggest that, and to make this thing better, we've got to make sure we hear from our local experts in the field. So thanks for the time. Appreciate it, Mr. Chair Fisher.
Thank you, Representative Baker. I also agree that I think there is a whole heck of a lot of information here and that we all have a lot of homework to do. I also want to say thank you to Representative Frankie for his idea earlier, too, because I also think that's an excellent idea to get that information kind of condensed there in one place anyway. So, and I'm also glad that we're continuing this conversation at the next committee meeting. Hopefully, all different ways that we're trying to address some of those concerns. But with that, I believe that Mr. Ashley Wortman will be able to go over the third article briefly here, and then we can have any final questions.
Thank you. And to Representative Baker, we would be very happy to continue to connect this committee with folks who have been a part of this process. We couldn't have gotten to this point without stakeholder input. And so just absolutely happy to make sure that you're connecting with all those folks and hearing their experiences too. I think that was the most important thing that we had on the 10th was our stakeholders. Within Article 3, and I really will try to keep this very brief, we're making all the conforming changes that we have to, taking out, in those 47 different places where we had mental health professional, are we now referencing back to the corrected definition that is going to be solid going forward. And so in sections 1 through 3, that's about correcting references to the current R29s, mental health professionals. Section 4, we modify the Healthcare Bill of Rights so it then accepts the cross-references that we're making within the USS Core. Sections 5 through 9, are about residential facilities, making sure that we're now including the new 245I-23 for ERTS RCS. And then Adult Mental Health Act language in 10 through 28 is edited for conformity with USS definitions. This is about references to professionals, treatment plans, diagnostic assessments. We correct an error that had a Medicaid non-compliant timeline for DAs and ITPs. Children's Mental Health Act, we do the same. We correct those mistakes around DAs and ITPs. We also correct the definitions for crisis planning, day treatment, and intensive treatment and foster care to reflect the present state. 45 through 46 are about the mental health clinics, the R29s. In sections 47 through 51, we edit 245A, the Human Services Licensing Act, and we correct some references in 245D and 254B to have the correct citations. In 52 through 56, this is about correcting individual and family peer specialists to remove material that we moved over to the core and to clarify the intent of those services and where they can be offered. In 57 through 56, we maintain coverage for ERTS in the Medicaid chapter, but the standards are then referred to in the USS core. Same thing for ACT. We maintain coverage, but align the standards. We remove some of the material from definitions on the advice of the revisor that there was too much policy getting done in the definition, and it's relocated to service standards. 66 through 73, we maintain coverage for ARMS and correct to align with USS. We again remove material from definitions and relocate to service standards. 74 through 78, this is about pieces that are in 256B0625. This is a large section of covered services. We correct to use the USS citations, primarily around mental health professionals and clinical trainees. Community mental health center standards are modified to reflect the new citations. We also add flexibility on a very rare service type, multifamily group therapy. We heard particularly from folks in rural areas, this could be hard to offer and wasn't always present. And we add a little bit of flexibility there for providers.
Mr. Ashley, we're
in 83. Yes.
I'm going to ask you, in the interest of time, to skip down to the repeal part. Because I would guess that would be, if we have some questions, that's where it might come from.
Yes. So within the repealer, we're pulling out some duplicative language that is in the Mental Health Acts. There were some pieces of peer services that are now relocated. Same thing for ACT, ARMS, CTSS. Children's Crisis, 256B, 0944 is repealed in its entirety because now 256B 0624, the previous adult section, now covers children. Intensive treatment and foster care, we end up pulling a few sections out. They're now duplicated in the core. And some services in 256B 0625 are moved over into 256B 0671. This has to do with how we're using shared definitions and combining the services where it does make sense to have common standards. Within the rule repeal, we repeal what's referred to as Rule 28 and Rule 29. These both covered mental health clinics and centers. They have conflicting requirements, and certainly Rule 28 really hasn't been used for some time and has only caused confusion for folks. Rule 29 is a little bit more recent, but still very archaic, and that's replaced with 245I.20. We also pull out some material that is in the outpatient mental health rule in Rule 47, 9505-0370 to 0372. That material is replaced by USS core standards, with mental health clinics under 245I.20, and some of the other language that we've already walked through.
With that, unless there are Seeing your hands raised, I will give Chair Fisher the last word.
Thank you, Chair Frederick. Thank you, everyone, for the opportunity to talk through this. At the next meeting, we will be going into this with other bills. The intent is to get the amendment on. I will make sure that we've got the Senate revision out to everybody as soon as it's available, so that we've got one document with everything together. I think that will help with the clarity. And I appreciate the suggestions that folks have been making. And I agree that it's good to make sure that we're checking back with our providers, making sure we've got input. I do want to remind people that we did have a couple of providers testify to us on this when we had the initial review by the department on the 10th of February. So I'll be going back and also reviewing that segment of our meeting and playing it back to make sure that we're not missing anything in the process. And I would recommend people continue to reach out to me or the department with questions. And thank you, Paul, for your input and questions today.
All right. Thanks, everybody, for the discussion today. It was my first time chairing. Hopefully, I didn't screw it up too bad. Other than a slight delay in getting to Representative Franke's first question. But if anybody does have any questions, I encourage you to follow up with the department or any other stakeholders. And we will lay the House File 1495 over. And with that, we are adjourned.